what I'm going to do is try and build on those previous two talks, which were excellent, and think a little bit about what it is that impacts what we grow. Since we know what we grow impacts what we eat, what actually helps determine what we grow? And I'm going to lay this in a historical context and in a also in a policy context. And it's very appropriate because you may not be aware, but tomorrow the Senate votes on the farm bill that it's been negotiating for 3 or 4 months. And of any kind of legislation, federal or state, that huge farm bill is probably the one thing that most determines what we grow in this country. So, Dr. Davis talked about conventional agriculture, and you know, it wasn't always conventional the way we currently practice it. It's what we now have is really sort of an industrialized model of agriculture, which is very yield focused, and that has come about for a number of reasons. Let me just point out this excellent source. Tim Lang is a food policy researcher in the United Kingdom who is very readable, and this book is excellent. And he talks about this productionist model that has come to bear. What it's replaced by and large is the picture of a farm that we still see on milk cartons and other food products, but really that you don't see much in the countryside anymore. And that model, that was kind of the pre-war, pre-industrial model, was primarily pastoral. It involved farms that grew a lot of different things instead of just one thing. And the resources that were used in that kind of agriculture were largely from on the farm. About 100 years ago, 120 years ago, a whole variety of forces came into being that changed that model. Some of these were innovation. And new technologies like tiles draining fields in Iowa, mechanization, new transportation infrastructure, and then the chemical revolution, which brought primarily fossil fuel-derived nitrogen fertilizers and pesticides. And all these have served to create this new conventional agriculture, which is really a productionist model. And that model, in contrast, is one that's very specialized, just like factories are, very concentrated in terms of what it produces and where it produces it. It's much more large in scale, not local in scale, and it makes very intensive use of off-farm resources, and these include a lot of fossil fuel-derived products. So, the picture here is of a gentleman named Henry Wallace, and he was Franklin Roosevelt's agriculture secretary. And he thought long and hard about what were the factors that determined the agricultural landscape. Because during the time of the Great Depression, one thing we had was a huge glut in production of commodity crops like corn. We weren't producing soybeans yet, as Dr. Hiblin pointed out, but we had a lot of corn. And actually, the farmers couldn't sell it. They had so much of it, and nobody was buying it. And so it was just going to waste in the fields. And at the same time, people were hungry. And what Wallace observed is that because of some factors that are inherent to agriculture, these commodity farmers are going to tend to overproduce regardless of the price that they see. So if the price is low, they're going to try and produce more. If the price is high, like it is right now, they're going to try to produce more. And some of those factors are farmers love to see fence row to fence row production. Aesthetically, it looks really good to them. They don't like to see pockets of unfarmed land. For many of these corn farms, there isn't much else that they can farm in that land. One of the factors used to be that they were far from the urban market centers, so they couldn't grow things like fruits and vegetables prior to better shipping because they couldn't ship it in time to the markets without it spoiling, whereas grain crops were very shippable. And then maybe the most important factor is that to a lesser extent today, but still to a true extent, a single producer cannot affect the price in the marketplace. And so really no matter how much any single producer produces, they're not going to affect the market price of corn. Well, what Wallace did was to put in place some policies that helped to create a very diverse landscape. And this is a schematic of a county in northeastern Iowa near Winnebago. And what you see from these colors, you don't have to read all the particulars, but what you notice is that it's a very diverse set of crops. It's a very diverse landscape. And this gives it some resilience, because biological systems that are diverse tend to have more resilience in the face of things like pest outbreaks or drought. But it also had another effect. Through a series of different mechanisms, Wallace put in place policies that actually managed the supply of corn so that people didn't overproduce. And one of the side benefits of that is that it took surplus corn off the market in times of glut, and it released it back onto the market when there were shortages, and it stabilized the price. It effectively acted like a minimum wage for farmers. It created a floor price, more or less. And so the farmers actually earned what it cost to produce their crop, and that kept them on their farms, which is a good thing. What it didn't include was any kind of direct payment or subsidy to these farmers. They didn't need it. They were getting paid for their work. They didn't need any direct payment. Well, since the mid-1970s, when the new agriculture secretary was Earl Butz, and he put in place, he made it his mission to get rid of these old programs and to replace them or start replacing them with programs that specifically had as their intent cheap food and overproduction, primarily these commodity crops, corn and increasingly soybeans and other commodities. And his goal was fence row production. And it might seem kind of funny, but the rationale was to produce such enormous surpluses that we could export to other countries this cheap crop, and that would keep farmers in business. That didn't happen. Instead, what happened was that we saw 3.5 decades of consistently declining market prices for these commodities. Supply and demand. We produced more, and lo and behold, the market prices kind of dropped down to the barrel. Now, keep in mind that what a farmer needs to break even is somewhere in the, I think, $2 or $3 a bushel range. And so for a substantial part of the last 35 years, farmers haven't even earned from the market what it cost them to produce these crops. So what has been put in place are explicit policies to keep farmers producing, to keep them out of bankruptcy, by giving them direct payments, subsidies. And these were so-called emergency payments under the 1996 Farm Bill, but it quickly became clear that they couldn't be emergency. They had to be semi-permanent in order to keep farmers in the business in the face of these low, low prices. So what are the features of this really industrialized agricultural model? Well, in terms of grain production, it really creates these monocultures. Instead of landscapes like Winnebago, Iowa, that are really diverse and multi-crop, now we have landscapes where all you see is corn. And increasingly, there are farmers who don't even rotate between corn and soybeans. They just grow corn all the time. Now, there are some issues with this. One is that corn is a very thirsty crop. So it uses off-farm water in many cases, but it also uses, again, because it's not a resilient, diverse farm production culture, you need to use synthetic pesticides, synthetic fertilizers to replace the fertility in the soil because you're no longer putting manure from animals in the soil. Instead, you're putting nitrogen fertilizers on the soil. And then we've also created monocultures of animal production, and these use a lot of electricity. So I don't know if you're like me, we're visiting some of the climate change talks over the last 2 days. So this is the intersection between conventional or industrial agriculture and climate change. Now, as I said, we've gone from a period where 100 or even 50 years ago, the average farm would have produced 4 or 5 different things, different commodities, whether it be animals or crops. Today, the average farm produces one crop. And for an increasing percentage of the American farmscape, it's just corn. Now, corn and soybeans together, and looking at cropland, is about 60% of all cropland. Now, this has direct impacts on how we produce animals, too. They're closely related. And I'm going to talk about some of those features. As I said, the animal environments are increasingly specialized, too. And as the model has evolved, more and more this production is concentrated indoors for pigs and chickens and poultry, concentrated in outdoor feedlots for beef cattle. And this has implications for farm animal health and behavior. And so there are things like crates and cages to control animals behaving aggressively because they're stressed out in these environments. And they're really not that healthy in many cases. It's got implications, too, for what you feed the animal. Because if you really want to increase yield and crank out as many animals and as much meat in as short a time as possible, you're going to invest a lot in breeding, but you're also going to try and capture optimal feed systems and deliver it to the animals in a way that you can keep them indoors and control all these different factors. And in fact, feed, about 60% of all the corn we produce and about half of the soybeans actually don't go to the human food supply at all. They go to animals as feed. And from a cost standpoint, this is the single most important factor in the cost structure for the larger scale meat producers that use these feed grains. Now, another integral part of this yield-focused system is feed additives, because if you want to, within the rationale of this system, if you want to get the biggest animal to market in the quickest possible time, you're going to put things in the feed to make them grow faster. And there's very routine use of antibiotics in poultry production, arsenical compounds, as well as the animal byproducts. For example, it's completely legal to grind up cattle byproducts and feed them to poultry flocks, and it's also legal to grind up poultry offal and feed it back to cattle. So, and then I added in hormones because these are also growth-promoting substances. They're usually injected. They're not in the animal feed. But these are all part of these synthetic off-farm inputs that are really an integral part of this process. And there isn't great data on exactly how much of our antibiotics or antimicrobials we feed to animals, but the best estimates that we have are that about 70% of all the antimicrobials used for whatever purpose, human or otherwise, about 70% are actually feed additives to beef cattle, poultry, and swine. So this has impacts, and we already heard about some of the nutritional impacts, and this is kind of the schematic I have for thinking about what I heard from Dr. Davis and Dr. Hiblin. We heard about dilution effects, decreased concentration of nutrients. We heard about how a soy-dominated industrial agriculture system may affect the fatty acid profile in our individual diets. And then I want to focus a few comments on how these impact on obesity. So, can U.S. farm policy impact obesity? That was a question I had. Well, first, what is farm policy? I mentioned the Farm Bill, and this is a description of the 2002 Farm Bill, the preceding version. And it had, as you see, 10 different titles. I highlighted a few of the most important ones. These include, for example, the nutrition programs, the biggest part of the Farm Bill. Because farm policy for the last half century or so has really had two not entirely easy companions, goals. One goal is to support nutrition, and it's done that through these nutrition programs, $33 billion a year in the food stamp program. And the other goal has been to support U.S. agriculture, and as I've explained, increasingly that's industrial agriculture, and much of that's done through this first title, the commodity title, and that amounts to about $16 billion a year. So still a big number, not as big as food stamps, but still a big number. And then finally there's the research title, which is much smaller, about $1 billion a year, but much of it to support this industrial model of agriculture. through its support of research programs at land-grant universities, for example, and extension services. So we had this hypothesis: what is the impact of farm policy and obesity and the epidemic of diet-related disease? And so, along with our partners at the Healthy Eating Research Program and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, we actually put together a small conference earlier this year in Wisconsin, bringing together 40 leading experts in obesity research, public health policy, and agricultural policy to talk about this issue. And we had a couple of objectives for the meeting that are mentioned here. And we came up with some broad principles coming out of the meeting, and they included the idea that public policy should support rather than hinder a health-promoting food system. And second of all, that whatever agricultural policies we have, they ought to be realigned so that the American diet's actually consistent with our guidelines for what it means to eat a healthy diet. Currently, they're out of alignment. My organization did a background paper for this conference in addition to helping to organize it. And this was the name of, we did two background papers actually. One was a primer on the Farm Bill and what it is. And the second was this paper right here. And you can get copies at healthyreadingresearch.org. And we just pointed out that what Americans consume is entirely consistent with what it produces. And in fact, what we overconsume, namely added sugars, added fats, refined grains, and to a lesser extent, meat, is entirely consistent with our farm policy, which promotes corn, much of which becomes sugar, soy oil, much of which becomes consumed fats, and refined grains. And many of those unrefined grains are then fed to meat, so I guess meat too. But it's interesting that this has had an impact not only on what's produced, but its pricing relative to more healthy food items like fresh fruits and vegetables. And so what we did was to take USDA data and normalize it back to constant dollars, and then looked at the change over time in the relative prices. And remember, Earl Butz started changing farm policy in the mid-70s, and we think there's a very interesting association or correlation with some of these price trends with some of the policy changes. And so you see an actual decrease in the real price of things like soda pop, a primary component of which is high fructose corn syrup, fats and oils, 80% of which are soy oil, sugars and sweeteners, the majority of which is high fructose corn syrup, and then meats, the major cost of which is feed grains, as compared to fresh fruits and vegetables, which have increased in real prices about 40% in that time period. So just trying to wrap up a little bit, when people have looked at obesity, as Putnam did, USDA researcher, they've noted that a key thing seems to be excess calorie intake. And over this time period, from 1985 to 2000, in fact, they see in the food supply what amounts to a per capita increase of about 300 calories per day in terms of excess production and therefore excess consumption, because they deducted out exports of food and spoilage and things like that. Well, where does that excess calorie consumption come from? About a quarter of it comes from added fats, and we heard about added fats from Dr. Hiblin. About another quarter of it comes from added sweeteners. Is this sugar? Well, as it turns out, no, it's really not. And if we look historically at what's happened to sweetener intake, it's increased on the whole, but the really interesting story is comparing sucrose from sugar cane or sugar beets, which, by the way, has an entirely different price support program, more in keeping with that Henry Wallace instituted. It's a supply managed program, versus high fructose corn syrup, which has greatly increased in terms of consumption. And so I want to just mention some of the other impacts, because I think we can get too focused on the nutritional impacts without acknowledging that the industrial model for food production has sorts of all sorts of other adverse health impacts. So let's just talk about a few of those. One is concentration, and concentration of ownership. It is public health related, at least in terms of community health and economic health of our rural communities. And so, for example, the fact that we have had below that the policies we have in place have kept the actual market prices for corn and soybeans below what it costs to produce them has amounted to an indirect subsidy of the largest meat producers, okay, to the tune of about $20 billion over an 8-year period with the broiler industry and the hog industry. And if you look and you recognize how consolidated these industries are, you see that the majority of that benefit accrues to just the top four companies. So this is a multi-billion dollar subsidy of the biggest, most industrial meat producers. And that's information from Tufts University. They have an excellent group there that's looking at some of these issues. It's also concentrated on the farm, the size of the farms. It's made them larger in scale. And so here you see USDA data looking at what's happened to hog farms just since 1994. And you see that the largest farms, those over 2,000 hogs, have increased greatly in number. The number of operations with at least 2,000 hogs has gone up greatly, and now it's about 75% of all hog farms. At the same time, the number of farms has decreased dramatically. So we have fewer farms, but the farms that we do have are a lot bigger and have more hogs. And then finally, this concentration at the farm level has led to a real concentration in terms of waste. And by waste, I mean animal manure. I could use another word, too. This is untreated sewage, okay? And the amounts are staggering. An estimated 2 trillion pounds of wet manure translates into about 340 million pounds of dry manure yearly. As I said, untreated manure waste. But think of all the additives in the feed, most of which end up in manure. So this manure not only has manure, it has bacteria, it has antibiotics, it has arsenic, and it has antibiotic-resistant bacteria in it too. And so if you saw one of the presentations today about some of these issues, we talked about MRSA. Well, there is, in fact, pretty good literature showing that pig farms are reservoirs for MRSA strains, and that when you have farms that use antibiotics, they tend to have higher levels of MRSA, and this MRSA is transmitted from the pigs to the farmers, their families, and to veterinarians, too. And I've got a whole array of 6 different sources in the bottom there. And then finally, climate change. The Food and Agriculture Organization released this report in the summer, and it made the point that globally, about 18% of greenhouse gas emissions can be traceable to livestock production, more than the transport sector. So we heard a lot in the climate change sessions about transport, alternative vehicles, not much about alternative agriculture. This number is probably a little lower for the U.S., but still significant. So let me just wrap up by saying that increasingly within the nutrition community, there's a focus on food systems to try to take into account these different issues we're talking about. The Giessen Declaration was a declaration that nutritionists assembled in Europe came up with in 2005, and they made the point that we need to really redefine nutrition to take into account food systems, as well as other principles like conservation. And the American Dietetics Association has done something similar. And I want to just finish up here by pointing out that your association, the APHA, is also quite active in advocating for better models of agriculture, including in the Farm Bill. And if you go to the website, you can find the action alert here calling upon members who are interested to actually call the Senate by tomorrow and tell them to pass a healthy farm bill. And some of the things that this might include are these things: increasing fresh fruit and vegetable programs in schools, many of which, ironically, are delivered through the Department of Defense, and some other things too. And then I'll wrap up, and hopefully we'll have 10 minutes for questions. And then I won't go into these, but just to say that, again, there are many more ecological health benefits from a food system that is more sustainable and less industrialized. It doesn't mean less yield. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to talk about a recent study coming out of University of Newcastle showing that yields can actually be much higher in organic systems than in conventional industrial systems. So, but there are some of these other benefits as well. Thank you.